Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The Park City School Board looking at adding more administrative positions for next school year. That after last year where some 26 new positions were created, mostly administrative. Joining me now in the studio with a recap of yesterday's budget discussion, I have School Board President Andrew Kaplan along with Business Administrator Todd Hauber. Good morning.
Good morning.
So the school district really hasn't grown in the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. Why are we've got so many hires happening in administration?
Well, if you look at, I think, the current proposed budget, there's 13 and a quarter headcount being added. And I believe of those, around seven or eight are actually teaching positions in the schools. One of them is a reclassification, someone that was paid for by the Ed Foundation and now is going to be paid for by the district. So the real net add at this point is not significant. But I think we also are still building our way back from, I think, being understaffed in terms of administration as well as having cuts. So, you know, the previous school board made a conscious decision to cut administration. And, you know, in the last couple of years, we've realized that we may have gone a little bit far in that, and we're rebuilding. Now, some of the roles that I think are being classified as administration are they are not teaching roles, but they're not necessarily people sitting in the district office either. They're, you know, whether that's an instructional coach or an interventionist or a crisis manager, things like that. One of the jobs is a safety coordinator or a safety manager. And so, why are we doing that? Well, we've realized that, you know, we need someone full time to help coordinate drills, best practices, review our facilities. We're spending quite a bit of money this year and next on upgrading facilities from a safety perspective and looking at those programs. And it's certainly top of mind given the amount of school shootings that have taken place, unfortunately, in our country. And, that requires a full-time role. Our other administrators just don't have the bandwidth for that. So it's a combination of things.
So where's the board coming down? Because we were talking about elementary interventionists and then also assistant principals at all of the schools.
Yeah, so we're continuing to look at both of those. There's a need for both additional interventionists. You know, we have elementary schools with 600 kids, and we have one interventionist at each of them. I think part of it, from the board's perspective, is identifying how many children are in need of intervention, and that's a big part of it, and that's what we're asking for in terms of data. But we know that through our own children's experiences that we're shorthanded and we need more bandwidth there. And so we're continuing to look at that and work with the building principals as well as the administration to figure out our needs. And then in terms of additional assistant principals, there's a couple reasons why you want to do that. One is to free up time for the principals to really be instructional leaders and go spend more time in the classroom working with their teachers, as opposed to just simply working with disciplinary issues and administrative tasks. And so that's the main focus. And then the other benefit is that you build a bench of talent, right? You have people who are coming up through the ranks, who spend time in our district and get to know our district and then become the next principals as our principals move on or switch schools or whatever they may do. So there's a number of different reasons why that's an attractive program for us to have. Whether or not we fit it into this year's budget or it comes into next year's, that's still up for discussion.
So what are we talking about in terms of new positions? Do we have a number yet?
Well, the current proposal is 13 and a quarter.
Mm-hmm. And that includes the seven.
And that includes our teachers. Mm-hmm. We have the teacher adds are pretty evenly split across the different schools. I think every single school is getting one teacher or thereabouts.
Pretty close, yeah.
Maybe it's six of the seven. So it's pretty, that's pretty widely spread.
Okay. So to pay for it, we're considering a tax increase, mm-hmm. And also having to dip into the rainy day fund by about $5 million.
Yeah, and that was by design. When we put the budget together last year, we knew that we wanted to bring down that surplus or that rainy day fund to the recommended level because we were over committed on that. So that made sense that we'd bring that down to an appropriate level. So that bought us a year of no taxes. But as we look at long-term sustainability, we need to bring that online so that expenses and revenues are in balance with each other.
Okay. And then in terms of the tax increase, that's just a property tax levy that you can use for anything, or are you talking about specifically raising?
So we're looking specifically at what's called the board local levy, and that's one that the board is able to adjust as needed to balance the budget. It when it is increased, it requires a truth and taxation hearing. So that's a hearing that will take place in the month of August. Dates will be coordinated with the county auditor as we get closer to that time. But that's when the truth and taxation hearing will be. Next month, we're planning to have the preliminary budget hearing, which basically would lay out what the game plan is for expenditure and financing of the district. Again, that'll be a hearing, so it'll be after 6 p.m. At a regularly scheduled board meeting, most likely the second meeting in May.
Okay, so if we take out the $5 million, we are left with about $16 million again in the rainy day fund that can be used for anything.
Correct. That is revenue that's available to the board for all education purposes.
Okay. Andrew, you were commenting that the board is talking about perhaps using the capital levy as a way to buy property for a new school.
Yeah, so one of the other, you know, Todd just discussed the board levy. Another tax lever that we have is a capital levy, and that can be used, as it's stated, for only capital projects such as buildings or, you know, capital expenditures. And we're currently looking at a number of properties in the district for future land use. And, you know, there's fewer and fewer available right now. You know, we did a demographic study at the district, and it shows that our student population is going to grow from about 5,000 kids to 5,800 children there or thereabouts using different models in the next 10 years. So that's a, you know, that's a 15% increase in our student population. And if you look around at our schools, all of our elementaries have trailers right now. Our high school is at capacity. We're looking to put the ninth grade back into the high school. So we know that we need some more space. And, you know, there's obviously different ways to do that. We can build additions onto our existing schools. We can also look at building new schools and having smaller campuses. And as we enter master planning this fall, we want to be able to give the community as many options as possible. But, you know, in terms of future planning, we're definitely considering some land purchases, and that would require some extra funding.
Yeah, the district already owns a couple of parcels at least, right? I mean, Bear Hollow, Silver Creek, something in the Silver Creek Village as well?
Right. So we own something in Silver Creek. That piece of property doesn't have any – it's raw land, so there's no utility hookups. There's no road to – I mean, there's a dirt road leading to it, that type of thing. So that is going to be very difficult to develop in the near term. The property we have at Bear Hollow is 8 acres, which is very limiting in terms of what type of school we could have there, possibly an elementary, but that's about it. You know, we do have additional land at Ecker. We have some other, you know, some other space, but, as we grow and we see where the growth is coming, it's coming, you know, here in, you know, Park City proper, especially at Quinn's and in the affordable housing developments that the city is focused on. And then out kind of in that trailside area, where there's a lot of development as well. And then there's other, you know, and that's what we know about that's actually permitted. There's other things, there's other pieces of property that we've been hearing are also going to be developed, which are inside of our boundaries. So we just have to be prepared for, you know, for this growth and for the overflow of students. So,
yeah. So what kind of school are we talking about building? Do we know?
We don't know at this point. I mean, I think there's it depends on what the community wants, right? I mean, if the community decides that they want to have one mega high school, then you know, we're good with the high school we have, or we can renovate it or build, you know, leave it on the Kearns campus. If they want to have two campuses that are smaller, we could do that. We could potentially look at another middle school. We could look at an additional elementary school and an elementary school and a middle school. There's a lot of different options that we're going to provide the community, and it will really be up to parents and community members to decide what types of schools they want and what they want their graduates to look like.
Yeah, I guess though, when you start talking about a capital levy, a tax increase to buy property, I mean, do we buy 40 acres for a high school or 25 for a school?
Yeah, so the pieces of property that we're looking at are, you know, in that 40 to 50 acre range, which would be able to put, you know, large middle school campuses or high school or multiple school campuses, similar to what we have at Kearns. And there's, you know, synergies of having, you know, larger campuses than everything spread out. So.
And did we just talk about selling the Silver Creek and Bear Hollow parcels?
I don't think we're planning on selling those. You know, I think there's always the possibility that, you know, we look at, you know, trading that land with, you know, with a municipality for open space or something like that. But, you know, we're not planning on selling them. I think right now both of them are difficult to develop because of the geography of them. They're not ideal for probably what our needs are going to be. So we're looking at increasing our land options so that, you know, we have the ability to give people options.
So are we moving ahead then with plans to increase the capital tax levy as well in addition to the...
We're considering it. It's one of the discussions, and we kind of started it yesterday, and we're going to continue it into the spring alongside our budget discussions. And, you know, what we do know is that there, with the 15% increase in our student population over 10 years, we're going to be building new buildings. It may be additions on our existing buildings. It may be new buildings. It may be land and buildings. All of those things are going to cost us money. And our two options to pay for that are the capital levy and a bond issue. I think it's probably likely to be both of those things, a capital levy and a bond issue. And really, we just don't want to get too far behind in terms of our needs and be kind of beholden to the election cycle. So we have, you know, money if we need it, if there's a piece of land that presents itself that we can go and acquire it. So it's a possibility. It hasn't been decided yet.
Okay. Well, then can you give us the worst case scenario numbers then, Todd? I mean, if we go with a $20 million increase in the capital levy in addition to the board local levy, I mean, what are we talking about potentially?
So it, just kind of some of the basic maths is that for every $1 million that you want to raise in tax revenues, it costs a private homeowner about $20 on a value of $650,000 home. So you can scale from there. You know, if you need 20 times that, it's what, $200 or
it's $400. So, I mean, it depends, you know. I mean, and one thing to point out, and this is something that Todd explained to us yesterday, is with the changes from this past legislative session and some of the taxes that have been and the recapture that have been implemented, if we did nothing, you know, our taxes, if the local school board did nothing, the line item on everyone's tax receipt would probably be going higher because there's more recapture. There's more, you know, some of the levies have gone up at the state level. So, you know, we're looking at a situation where we're conscious that the county's increasing taxes, the city's increasing taxes, the state has kind of increased taxes on education, and it's not something that we're going to take very lightly. But we also realize, okay, we made a decision 2 years ago to or a year and a half ago to pay all of our employees a better wage, and that's going to result in tax increase. And then we also have to do some future planning with regards to facilities, and that's also going to require an increase. So, yeah, I mean, that's the calculation. It's $20 per million. And if we did a $20 million tax increase, which I would say is highly unlikely that we would do something to that extent, it would be, you know, $400 a house. But I don't think that's, you know, what we're looking at.
Yeah, that's like almost doubling the school taxes as we've got them, no?
So the school taxes are about $1,400 on that same home.
Okay, so by a third then.
Yeah.
So why are we doing this now? I thought we're creating a master plan. And I mean, how do we? I mean, we're taxing people for stuff we don't even know what's happening.
Well, as I said, we know, you know, there's two taxes here. One is operating taxes, and we know about that. That's something that we've been planning on. We gave the community a, you know, kind of a year pass because we had the surplus. But it's something that we decided was important because of paying wages to all of our employees, you know, everyone from the bus driver to, the principals, right? We needed to increase because we're, you know, it's not a living wage. So that's one part of it. And the second part with regards to capital is we know we have, you know, 800 more kids coming. We know that that's happening. And so we don't know necessarily what buildings we're going to have, what land we're going to have. But we also know that everything gets more and more expensive every year here in town. And we have to be prepared to have the capital ready to, you know, to be able to purchase something. And that's what we're discussing. You know, again, it's not decided, but it's, I think, just prudent financial management at this point.
Yeah, and I think that was part of the problem during the last bond election was basically the board saying that, you know what, if you don't approve the bond, we're going to raise your taxes. Well, you're raising you're doing what former board members said they were going to do anyway then. The bond didn't pass, and now we're
what was being said was they were going to raise the taxes to pay for the facilities, which was, I don't know, $56 million. So this is definitely on a different scale, right? You know, the reality is that we know we have to build buildings. We know we have to expand our facilities. It's going to cost taxpayers. There's no way around that. And so, you know, we are going to have to bond. There's no way around that either. And that's going to be a significant bond. It's probably going to be larger than the, you know, than the $50 million. It may not be $50 million in one shot, or it may not be $100 million in one shot. It could be a series of bonds issues. But over the next 10 years, we need more space. And so to start that, one of the things that we can do is a capital levy, and that's why we're exploring it.
So is that short term, or is that something
that would be a short term? That would be a short term, you know, way to raise funds.
Let's talk briefly about fee schedules. The board voted 4-1 to adopt the new fee schedule. That means that we've got to come up with another $700,000 to pay for. And we're talking about athletic and academic fees.
No, so. The board made a decision based on equity for children. And traditionally in our district, we have charged fees to students starting at Ecker Hill all the way through the high school for things such as gym uniforms, textbooks, you know, everything up to, you know, playing football, right? And what the board looked at was the academic and the mandatory fees. So by that, we mean fees that every child who attends our schools is forced to pay when we talk about the mandatory fees. And then in terms of academic fees, we're talking about things like textbook and school supplies. So, for example, if you take an AP chemistry class, there's a lab fee of several hundred dollars. There's textbook fees for AP classes. And, you know, as we have a conversation in our community, you know, being led by the city, being led by the community foundation about social equity, and we look at ourselves as educators and we look at equity for our students, we decided that the equitable thing to do as a public school is to pay for mandatory fees, right? It's a public school. It's not a private school. Children, every child should have the same right to take AP chemistry. It shouldn't matter if you have the $300 for the fees or you don't, right? And so that's what we decided to. We're essentially just transferring the burden from, you know, the students to the entire community was the decision.
But we always offered them waivers, didn't we?
Well, there's waivers for, you know, there's a waiver system. But that requires you going and applying. If you know, going into the office, filling out a form saying you don't have enough money, it requires families to make choices between classes and athletics, between all kinds of things. And it's a deterrent, right? The reality is it's hard enough for an adolescent to figure out what courses they want to take. It's a whole nother layer to say, you know what, you have to go talk to your parents, you have to go fill out forms, you have to go ask for a waiver, you have to decide whether or not you want to get, how many waivers you want to get. It's not in the spirit of what we want to be doing in terms of equity. So that's what was discussed, and that was the decision that was made.
Todd, where does that money come from then?
So it'll come from property tax. So we'll look at rebalancing the schedule that was out yesterday.
Okay. So, again, we're talking at the maximum, that $20 million plus?
No, so there's no $20 million. Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure where that...
I'm here in the capital. So we got up to $20 million for the capital increase.
No. I'm not sure what the limit is on our levies, but it's much greater than 20, but that's not what's being discussed. We're talking about, on the capital side, a potential increase, but...
Yeah, we didn't talk about a number on the capital side. It was just the idea that we would need to go to the capital levy for any land acquisitions before a bond cycle. So it wasn't a dollar. The only dollars that are in the budget right now are the about $4.3 million on the board local levy. So we're looking at that for this coming school year. And then looking in the out years, depending on what subsequent decisions are made, there's another $4.3 for 2020. So, you know, so maybe you get to 8.5.
And that's basically $120, $125 a year per house.
Okay. And then real quick, wanted to just talk about school safety. Any updates there?
Yeah, we had an update from our safety consultant, and there's a, you know, we started the construction on a bunch of the vestibules and some of the safety upgrades earlier in the year. When the safety consultant came in, they decided to redo some things. They've been working with the architects. The date that we've gotten in terms of being able to finish all those improvements, including installation of fences and things like that, are going to be by the beginning of school next year.
Okay.
So it's much later than we had originally hoped, but that's construction in Park City.
All right. You know. Andrew, Todd, hey, thanks for your time.
Thanks a lot.
KPCW News Time, 8:38. Good morning. Well, the Park City Council meeting in a study session Thursday starting at 3:15 to review the first phase of a nightly rental study. In the studio to discuss that along with the rest of the agenda, I have Park City Manager Diane Foster and planner Hannah Tyler. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Diane, at 3:15, the short-term rental market study. This was a joint study paid by the city, the Chamber Bureau, and Summit County. To do what exactly? I mean, what are we getting out of this?
So, Scream and Deal, each entity paid only $8,300, which is really, I mean, for these kind of and you know, some studies are more theoretical. This one is boots on the ground. How many units do we have? And very much, City Council has said vibrancy, community vibrancy is important, and we don't want to become a ghost town, right? Aspen actually made a film one year that was called Nobody's Home, and it was basically a warning to other resort towns. And so Professor and Dr. Brumby McLeod, who's going to be presenting, when he sat down with us and talked about the importance of looking at this, he framed it as this is really a housing study, not just a nightly rental study. So, right, getting a handle on who's in homes and what are they doing with their home. And the important part is being able to track it over time. So this piece is very much a baseline. You know, how many units do we have that are licensed versus how many are there out there? And so, for example, one of the findings was we've got about 2,000, a little over 2,000 licensed within the city. And then 400 within the county. And then countywide, we've got 4,200. So, right, like a couple thousand unlicensed. And that's very much for the city, first and foremost, a life safety. Also, it's a we think that properties shouldn't have a competitive advantage over our folks in the Lodging Association, specifically because they don't have to pay taxes. And so we think they should be paying taxes as well. You know, the city allows nightly rentals in lots of zones. And then you have ones like up on McHenry where the neighbors came in and said, we want to make those not legal. And the ones that were licensed got grandfathered. And there were some up there that weren't licensed and they did not get grandfathered.
So how do we know that this is, I mean, about these 4,200? I mean, how do you find that out?
So the group that we worked with, what they did was they tracked them. And so for example,
online?
Some
online, different...
they would track them online. And also they used a lot of different data sources. So they used GIS, they used our licensing databases. And so they did a lot of this to get a baseline is just data crunching.
So the goal in getting all this information then is to make sure that they are licensed and that they're paying taxes and what else?
The what else is very important. It gives you an idea of what's happening in your community. And importantly, when we look at the possibility of a phase two, where it's going in the future. So now that we've got this database and we've got all the data normalized, I think it's, you know, the city has a lot of nightly rentals and being able to see, hey, are we losing Park Meadows as a primary area? And the phase two actually is going to have some recommendations on updating some business processes, updating some ordinances, and looking where do we want to encourage these and where do we want to discourage them. And one of my thoughts is this is very important for the city. It's also important for the county where there aren't necessarily as a percentage as high as many nightly rentals, and being able to see there, you know, where does the county want nightly rentals and where are neighborhoods where people don't want them.
So does phase two cost another $25,000 total?
We're going to be Tom Fisher and Matt Dias, Jeff Jones and Bill Malone and I are going to be meeting tomorrow and looking at the proposal for phase two and which pieces we think are most important.
Okay. Let's turn to you, Hannah. The Affordable Housing Development amendments to the land management code, a result of the council's retreat that directed staff to create some goals and strategies using amendments. So what do people need to know here?
I think what they need to know is that there's existing code for master plan developments for affordable housing. No project has ever been able to use that section of code simply because some of the restrictions are pretty tight. And so what we're doing is just talking to them about more of a policy discussion on what changes they'd like to make to that section of code to incentivize both public and private developments to be able to provide affordable housing within city limits.
So what's this section of code that you're talking about?
It's actually called the Master Plan Developments for Affordable Housing. And so this is a section of code that is for affordable housing only. And so what we have is master plan developments are large-scale projects. And we have a specific section of code that's supposed to incentivize affordable housing by giving them some additional incentives than traditional projects.
So density bonuses.
Yeah, so we'd be looking at density bonuses, possibly some incentives for parking exemptions for micro units. So those are your studio units, 500 square feet or less. And really just ask for their direction on how far they're willing to go to hopefully incentivize this.
Okay, so how will these amendments help the city reach its affordable housing goals?
I think that both the city and private development will benefit because I think, like I said, currently no one can use this section of code, and the goal being is that by getting more density, we can hopefully get more affordable housing units and give them more incentives.
Okay, I guess I missed that. Why can't they use the code?
So right now there's a requirement of one parking space per bedroom. And that typically equates to more parking than what would be required for typical developments. And that's maybe not the only reason, but that's a big deterrent for that section of code.
Would any development then qualify?
What we're looking at is what percentage of the total project should be affordable housing. So right now you have to be 100% affordable housing to use that section of code. And we're looking at lowering that percentage requirement to allow some market rate units within an affordable housing project.
All right. Because what we've been told, I guess, is that the city needs to build its own affordable housing because we don't have the private developer building it and because of some of the regulations. Is that the idea here?
Yeah. And I think, just for an example, a couple of city projects would not have been able to use this code because they were not building completely affordable housing. So, for example, Woodside Park Phase 1 has one unit that's going to be retained by the city, and that did not make it 100% affordable. And so, yeah.
So is this benefiting Park City's projects moving forward?
It's benefiting both.
Or do we really have applications from other private developers?
I think if you look at what's the...
Woodside Park?
No, the one that Rory Murphy just did. I think that was a developer providing more affordable housing than what was required. And so I think it'd be helping someone like that as well.
Kings Crown Development.
So is this retroactive then for him? Or
no. He could go back through the process, but I don't see that.
And we do, Leslie, have a lot of developers who approach us and want to partner on a project. So this may make partnering more affordable. And if we think about affordability, it's also important to the taxpayer because the funds that the city spends are taxpayer funds. Please know, though, staff does not want to create parking issues, right? We do not want to reduce parking. One of the things you'll see in the report is that it actually talks about restricting how many cars somebody can have if they live in this unit, which you can do if you're providing that affordable piece.
Okay. Let's move on to the Environmental Sustainability Staff Report. It talks about the different programs the city has going on in conjunction with Rocky Mountain Power. What's the goal here?
From the high level, the goal is that by 2022, the city's own operations will be net zero, so no carbon emissions, and powered by completely renewable energy. And then community-wide for the city of Park City by 2032. That's the high-level goal. Part of the reason why we're doing this with Rocky Mountain Power and not trying to go on our own or look at some other way to do it is that, we're a small community. If we can be an example for the rest of Utah about how you can partner with your existing utility to achieve net zero, hey, that's a heck of a path.
So what's Rocky Mountain, though, doing for Park City to get your, reach your goals?
They're actually helping us a lot. So one of the things quite real that they did is recently they gave us a $250,000 rebate, so basically a grant, a $250, and that paid 75% of the cost of the new charging station at the Transit Center. Obviously, a really expensive project, very important towards our net zero goals, and that's stepping up with cash. They're also giving us incredible pricing on a lot of work that we need to do, a lot of the background work that we need to do. For example, engineering to look at what would a renewable facility look like. And that's one of the things. And that whole piece is costing us $31,000. You could never go out on the open market and get that kind of price for the level of depth that they'll be going to in this study.
Yeah, and I guess I don't really understand this. I mean, it kind of seems like it could just be a shell game, you know, that Rocky Mountain Power can just kind of move around its renewable sources so that it looks like Park City is net zero, and yet it's just falling with some other community. So what is it that they're doing to ensure that Park City is net zero? Right?
It's a really important question, and thanks for asking that. It's going to be similar to the way that in California, they have a renewable portfolio standard, and a lot of the wind power and other renewable power that's generated in Utah goes to California because of their renewable portfolio standard. What we're looking at may even be a little more specific than a renewable portfolio standard. We're actually looking at working with them to construct a dedicated renewable energy facility for the city of Park City.
Okay, so a solar farm, wind farm, something
like
that.
Yeah, and that may be in another part of the state if that's more cost. You know, if you think about if you built that in Vernal or down in Santa Quinn, that would be more affordable than building it in the Park City, Summit County area. However, and there's because there's so many states that do have renewable portfolio standards, the math and the regulation behind this is it's really proven already. Because, Leslie, what you mentioned, it's really important to us that it's not a shell game.
And I've heard this, but I didn't see anything in the report about it, but that our new electric buses have resulted in an 18% increase in the city's carbon output. Is that true?
So if you consider that we're now getting our electricity from about 80 to 85% coal, however, I think we're buying renewable energy credits for the bus system. You know what I'll do is I'll check with Luke because it's very important to us that that is a zero emission system. So I'll check with him on it.
Right, because if that's the case, it's one step forward, two steps back.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You know, and you asked Nam Worrell last week about the prospector units and being electric heat. As we look to make more things be net zero, and as we're bringing on renewable sources, we will want people to use more electricity and choose that over natural gas, for example, more electric vehicles versus gas vehicles. However, that's why, I am so impressed with Luke Carton and Celia Peterson because they are super focused on the renewable energy part and the electricity part. There is no more important thing in our net zero goal than that.
And then, Hannah, real quick, we're also looking at our land management code to make rooftop solar easier in all communities.
Yeah, so we're going to be addressing that, we'll be addressing that, and we'll be talking about that in relation to the historic district and then as a citywide movement towards that renewable energy goal.
Okay, because I just heard about another condominium project that it's like forbids solar panels in their houses.
Sure, and the city, we're never going to overstep someone's HOA regulations. However, I think peer pressure is a great way to change HOA.
Okay, Hannah Tyler, Diane Foster, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Connect Summit County offering a couple of opportunities for the community this week to hear from author and ESPN journalist Kate Fagan, along with renowned yoga instructor Catherine Budig. Both of them joining me now in the studio. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning.
First up is the Thursday at the Blair Education Center at Park City Hospital with you, Kate. It's happening at 6 o'clock. You've written the book, What Made Maddie Run, The Secret Struggles and Tragic Death of an All-American Teen. So maybe just start with that, the book and why you wrote that.
So the book comes from an ESPN piece that we did 4 years ago called Split Image, and it was about Madison Hollerin, this track star, soccer star, who died by suicide at a Division I school, the University of Pennsylvania. And so we wanted to write that story for ESPN because the immediate headlines after Maddie died was, and I'm quoting here, star student jumps to death over grades. And immediately I and my editors at ESPN, we were like, this story is so much more than that. There was so much more at play here. And so we wrote a magazine piece that tried to not find a why, because you're never going to find the exact why, but really try to tell a fuller story of maybe culturally and socially what was at play for kids like Madison Hollerin.
Yeah, and when you look at some of those themes, yeah. I mean, the perfectionism,
yep.
the drive, the transition to college, social media,
all of these things,
and then mental health. I mean, I guess what is it though when you look at that? This is years in the making, and you know, at what point does somebody insert themselves to change that outcome?
Well, I think after having reported and been a part of this story for 4 years, I can't ever say. It's almost this weird thing where I can say any and all moments could have been the difference because, you know, the thing I've learned is that when somebody's in that kind of fever, dark place of suicidal ideation, it's not inevitable that they're going to follow through with suicide. If any small things change, any phone call, you just never know. You can get them through that fever to the other side and get them the kind of help to continue their life. And certainly there could be struggles. So when you look at Maddie's story, I could tell you 20 different things that may have shifted the course of her life in some small way, but I can't tell you one thing. You know, so you can look at tech and social media and rising rates of anxiety. You can look at the pressures of Division I athletics. I mean, I could pull out so many different things.
Yeah. So on Thursday's presentation, I mean, tell us about that. What's going to happen?
Well, the goal is to really take people through some of the backstory, even behind the scenes of like what I learned reporting the book, because I don't want to assume books are hard to read these days. We're all addicted to our phones, or not everybody, a lot of us. And so the presentation is, look, when I sit down to dinner with somebody and they ask me about this story and this book and why rates of anxiety and depression are rising, here are the 6 or 7 things that fascinate me that I think are impactful. And I try to take the audience through some of those things so that they leave maybe seeing the world a little bit differently, seeing their relationship with their phone or their kids or the people in their lives or their own mind a little bit differently.
So is it geared towards parents or teens and both?
I think I tend to get parents to show up more often because it's like this highly valued concept of like, let me understand my kid better versus I think when you're a kid, it's not as valued to say, let me understand the world or my own mind better, but it's for everybody. I mean, whether or not you would say that you're someone who has struggled with mental health, at some point, all of us hit a patch in our lives. And so it's for everybody, not just athletes too, because a lot of us are feeling these kinds of pressures in our society and are part of the culture that are causing these rates of anxiety to rise.
All right. So you'll give a presentation and then what? Invite just kind of a community discussion?
Yes.
Is that the idea?
Yeah, because I want to make sure to open it up for questions because there's things specific to Park City that I'm not going to know about unless somebody has a question about them.
All right. I know that they are asking people to RSVP just so they know how many chairs to set up.
That's right.
People can find out more at connectsummitcounty.org. Then, Catherine, are you part of this? But I know you're also offering a yoga session at Tadasana.
Yes, we are a package deal for this trip. Connect very generously brought both of us out for this. And yoga, obviously, is a natural connection to this mental wellness topic. And so my offering is banking off of that in the way that I'm going to discuss the topic of perfectionism and striving for those lofty goals that often leave us feeling empty. So how can we kind of flip the dialogue on that so that when we're doing our practice, not only are we using our physical bodies and using that as a way to flush out the stressors that keep us back, but also kind of get into that, squeeze out the brain a little bit and try to get rid of the things that hold us down.
Well, and I think yoga is a great example of, I mean, we've all seen, maybe they're the pittas in the yoga class, but you know what? It's all about doing exactly perfect. And they're just even...
You know your doshas. You just said pitta.
Yoga can create that.
Yes.
Perfectionism.
It attracts that often. And so I feel like the role of the teacher is for me to welcome everyone, no matter what state they're in, and offer them the tools beyond physicality to hopefully see beyond a perfect alignment and a pose and execution and comparison to the person next to them and what they're doing.
Yeah. So tell me about what you've got going then at Tadasana. Is that filled? Because I know that there was limited space there.
I am not absolutely positive about that, but you can definitely check in with Tadasana and see. I believe we still have spaces, and it's a two-hour class. I'll be doing a little bit of talking, but lots of movement. I'm a very playful teacher, so my approach is not just to nail you with all of these theories about this is how you're going to be happy, but just to make people laugh and get them outside of what they think they should do. Basically.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of your style, is very playful and fun.
She's playful.
All right, so people, again, can go on to connectsummitcounty.org and have a look and sign up for that. So that happens Saturday morning. What's the timing on that?
10:30 to 12:30,
I believe.
Yep. Yes.
Okay. All right. And I think it's $70 or something.
Something like that.
Yeah. And then yours is free and open to the public?
Yep. And I think for people get a free book if they come. And
I think there's 100 copies that are being given out.
So I encourage people to stop by, because it will be, you know, hopefully an entertaining as well presentation that will make you think a little bit differently.
Yeah. Now, have you two worked together like this before?
Yeah. And we're together also. She's my fiance.
Okay. So congratulations. Okay.
So this was you know what? I think these two things can dovetail, and we can come check out the awesome city of Park City together. So.
Okay. Glad to have you. Thanks for your time this
Thanks.
Morning.
Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:59.